Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shayna Appel.
And he is Chris Owen.
Our mission is to connect moral thinking, moral reflection, moral philosophy, and Christian human-centered theology, connecting those things with our shared common life. Why do we do this, Shayna?
To get ourselves beyond the binaries of politics and economics, which dominate so much of the conversation in the public square, but which get us nowhere, much less anywhere near the realm of human flourishing.
Indeed, human flourishing is not measured by economics, and indeed, human flourishing is forgotten in the way we practice politics today.
Hear, hear.
We have a spinny wheel. It's our customary way to start our show. It injects a little randomness into our time together.
Our otherwise really tightly knit programming here.
Yeah, we don't want to get too scripted now, do we?
No.
Our spinny wheel is a bicycle wheel mounted on a piece of plywood. The plywood itself is divided into 16, count them, 16 different core values and key ideas. We spin the wheel, and whatever it lands on, Shayna and I do a little improv. We riff on the topic, the core value, key idea that it lands on. And my dear Shayna, I believe it is your turn.
My turn.
I always have to read the spinny wheel because Shayna cannot read my handwriting, but it has landed on, you can either choose be curious, Shayna, or listening.
Be curious. Because it's radically countercultural. You know, we live in a culture where people are expected to have answers and to jump to conclusions, and which stops us from wondering. And the place where we wonder together, I mean, if we come at an issue, I feel this way about it, you feel that way about it, that's the end of the conversation. But if we can approach even that conversation with a curiosity about, okay, great, we know that we disagree on this, but where do we agree? And, you know, furthermore, curiosity reflects an open heart and an open mind. And to go through life, to be encouraged to wonder, not always to know, just makes things so rich. I know I've worked in a number of congregations dominated by people who claimed to be humanists, who would probably self-identify as secular humanists, although I think they don't know the origins of humanism or honestly what is contained therein. You know, humanism does not mean one needs to cut oneself off from on wonder. And curiosity is a kissing cousin of those two, so... Yeah, I just love curiosity. What do you think, Chris? What are your thoughts on curiosity this morning? I'm curious to know. See what I did there?
I'm thinking of our statement that's been a focus for this program season. The moral norms necessary for the practice of democracy are not necessarily ensured by the practice of democracy. And I think of that with regards to curiosity because... curiosity strikes me as a moral norm that's necessary for the practice of democracy. So moral norm, not meaning a puritanical, moralistic kind of approach, which is how when some people hear the word moral, that's kind of where they go, like, what are the rules? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I use the word moral, I'm talking about basically a stance or an attitude towards other people that has a normative dimension, a dimension of what is praiseworthy and what is blameworthy. And so the moral norm of curiosity is something to be praised. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the second thing I want to say, something to be praised for a people or in a people or amongst a people that aims to be self-governing. That's the connection then back to democracy. The second thing I want to say is, being a philosopher, I am intrigued, like I'm drawn to the root meanings of words, the etymology of words. And curious comes from curia in Latin, which means to care. And so I imagine it's the same thing.
Sure, to care for, a collect, to curate, to gather, to care for.
Yeah, right. So sometimes we think of curiosity as something intellectual. I want to know something. I'm curious about it. But really, the root of the word is connected to heart, to care, which tickles me. It connects knowledge to passion, I think, curiosity.
And when one walks around in that posture, you know, if you will, a curious, an open mind and an open heart, we do get closer to human flourishing. Yeah. Certainly much closer than we get to it, you know, than let's say the op-ed page, for example. There's our tone indicating that it is time to move to the focus of today's conversation, which is, Chris,
a quote by Ralph Ellison. The quote is, I'm just going to read the quote, Shana, and then I want to give our listening community a little bit of who Ralph Ellison was. The Ralph Ellison quote that we want to talk about today is this: "The way home we seek is that condition of man's being at home in the world, which is called love, and which we term democracy." I'm going to read that again a little bit later after I do my little Ralph Ellison introduction, so I'm not going to say it again right now. But Ralph Ellison, just briefly, Shana, his dates, 1913 to 1994. He was a writer, and his most well-known novel is The Invisible Man, for which he won the National Book Award in 1953. That's a little while ago. So, and this quote that I'm going to read again shortly is the end of the speech that he gave when he was receiving the National Book Award for Invisible Man. Again, this is Ralph Ellison. "The way home we seek, the way home we seek, is that condition of man's being at home in the world, which is called love, and which we term democracy." A comment about this quote: it's very impressionistic. It's not expository. It's not analytical. It's impressionistic. He's connecting some very interesting and intuitively related concepts: home, love, and democracy. And I think, Shana, our conversation today, and we invite our listening community to play along at home, but it is our conversation is about, like, how do we see the connections between those three things? That's my little intro. Do you have a place to start, or how do you want to go?
I'm just reflecting on what you just said. You know, it's I love impressionist writing, because it puts an idea in front of you, but not like a gate. Or if it is a gate, it's open. You know, impressionistic writing throws out a couple of ideas that invite you in, but give you room to explore it on your own, doesn't answer sort of all the questions. So you have to engage impressionist writing with a curious heart.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, which makes it really cool. I was, doing some prep for today and found a couple of quotes that I just wanted to share, kind of get us going and get us thinking about things. John Tweedle wrote in an article, A Theology of the Home. He writes, "Christians have long viewed the home as the hub of life. It is now he's talking about the physical home. He doesn't stay there, but that's where it starts. It is a nursery for aspiring astronauts, playground for wannabe heroes, and sanctuary for weary but heaven-bound wayfarers. Home is a place for cultivating virtue, through meandering conversations, large helpings of laughter, hearty meals, excruciating trials, and loads of hard work. Whether you're a child learning to read, a freshman in a dormitory, newlywed setting into a first apartment, an upstart launching a career, a family with a quiver full of children, or a widow navigating life without a spouse, the comfort of home is a stabilizing reality of life. Yet.
I was wondering when the yet would come.
Yet.
That's
For many, the home is far from heaven. It is hell on earth. For those suffering in the environs of oppression, the home is a cauldron of abuse, violence, and manipulation. It is a prison to escape from, not a refuge to run to. Still, others have never had the privilege of permanent shelter, let alone experienced the warmth of a fireplace. As Christians discuss the value of home, we must not lose sight of the fact that the guilt and corruption of the fall reaches into every heart, and therefore into every home. Our ultimate hope lies not within the boundaries of a picket fence, but in Him who is our dwelling place.
So when I'll just give you the play-by-play of how I was listening to you go through that quote. And at the beginning, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so...
antithetical to what I just said.
So sweet and... you know,
right?
It's so idealistic
yes.
vision of home and what homes are. And then you got to the second part, mm-hmm. which brings, you know, it's the dark and the shadow side of what homes and families can be. And so, and that struck me as authentic. Like mm-hmm. the first part, I was like, oh my God, Shana's gone off the deep end.
I think it's a both and, though, Chris.
It is. So, yeah. So this is the second part of what I want to say is that, so what is it about home that, because the commonality between the beginning part of what you read and the second part of what you read is the power of the emotion. Mm-hmm. That's the connect to me. That's the connection. So what is it about home that evokes such strong feelings? Sometimes the feelings that we have with the people close to us are so strong they are intolerable. I can't even manage the emotionality that's involved. So I ask myself, what is it there that is so powerful? And to me, home is about the possibility of, because it's not always accomplished, the possibility of belonging. And belonging, if we want to pursue this, belonging is one of the basic human needs. And so the power of the emotion in family, I'm equating family and home right now. I mean, but we can draw it out to democracy as Ellison wants us to do. But just to stick with the family and home here, the possibility is that home is this place of belonging, but it also can be thwarted. And because it's such a powerful need for belonging, when it's thwarted, it's a huge threat and very dark and a hard place to be.
I come back again then to something that you've raised, we've talked about any number of times, which is that a thing untethered is potentially dangerous. Now, if we take this notion of home out into a broader realm and say, okay, Heidegger discussed the idea of dwelling in his works. He saw home as more than just a physical space, but rather as a place where we exist authentically and meaningfully. So if we cannot exist, whether the home be physical, whether the home be metaphorical, whether the home be our nation, our democracy, or even the confines of our own bodies, right? Yeah. If we reach for a definition of home as a place where we can exist authentically and meaningfully, then I think we're getting back to where our opening quote is taking us.
Yeah. The way home we seek is that condition of man's being at home in the world, which is called love, and which we term democracy. So my follow-up question to you is, how do you intuit the connection between home and democracy? I mean, if your Heidegger quote, if home is about authenticity, is there something about democracy that's about authenticity? That's an odd one. I mean, we don't often think of democracy as having to do with authenticity.
Well, but it has everything to do with the American notion of democracy. Yeah. And I'm talking very idealistically here, and sure. I realize, okay,
the
but ideal, the aspiration was that, you know, I know we talk about a melting pot, but I don't think the melting pot actually captures the aspiration. I think salad.
Yeah, okay.
Captures the aspiration. There will be carrots, there will be celery, there will be lettuce. We're not saying the carrots have to become lettuce or the lettuce have to become carrots. We are simply bringing it all together and then celebrating its beauty and nourishment and how wonderful that collective can be, right? I mean, we know that idealistically, obviously, we ain't there yet.
But a
place in a true democracy, right? People can be authentically, fully, and wholly who they are.
Ah, okay. Oh, that's really interesting. All right. So
and can live lives of meaning. They have acts, you know, that everybody has a shot to do something meaningful.
So here's a beyond the binary moment, because your salad metaphor lifts up two things that.
Maybe. Well, no, there was carrots, lettuce, and celery.
Well, the binary, though, is the
and
two...
And peppers and olives and... Yeah, right. Sorry.
Stop it. No, the binary are these two things, which is seeing the salad as a whole, as a one, which it is. A salad is a one, is a thing. And seeing at the same time its constituent ingredients, the many-ness of it. And oftentimes... we can't see both at the same time. We want to focus on the unity and we forget the individuality of the carrot and the pepper and the lettuce and the so on. So that's really intriguing. And of course, the melting pot image, which you rejected, is, you know, if something melts into another thing and they all melt together,
it's the Borg.
It's the what?
The Borg.
I don't know what that is.
Star Trek?
Oh, God.
Really? God, if you lived under a rock. So the Borg is this like cyber technological block of, I don't know, consciousness that drifts through outer space, but everybody who gets sucked up by it becomes a part of it and loses their individuality.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
So that's that. Yeah, take my word for it. I hope our listeners know what I'm talking about because I'm not sure I do. But... The idea that in a democracy, we do not need to think alike to love alike. You know, we do not need to think alike to love alike. We do not need to all enjoy the same foods or the same music or have the same understandings about God, about the purpose of a human life. We don't have to think alike to love alike. Having said that, and I'm jumping back here to previous conversations that you and I have had around these microphones, there have to be some common points, something that binds us each to each and each to all. Otherwise, the whole thing comes apart. And I think where we are right now is in that place where we've sort of injected so much individualism that the very notion that we ought to find a common maxim or something that we can agree upon, like just would cause a bunch of liberals to absolutely bristle. And conservatives, the uber conservatives as well. So the ultra left and the ultra right would bristle at this notion of, you know, we got to have something here. A game works because there is a goal and everyone playing the game understands what the goal is. So if the game is tennis, the goal is to get the ball over the net one more time than your opponent, right? You got to have some fundamental things. I've often said this about being a pastor in the Unitarian Universalist Church. Like, we've got principles and we've got sources, and thank God, because beyond that, we don't have a common narrative. The challenge is getting people to pay attention to the principles and the sources and or any covenants that they've come up with, because those are the things that bind us together in a denomination that doesn't have that common narrative that we have in Christianity. We may disagree on its interpretation, but at least, you know, the game is starting on the same court here.
So this is really interesting and
not at all where you wanted to go.
No. What? Shayna, come on. You are presuming that I actually had a place where we wanted to go. Let me try this on you. I mean, isn't home, family, I got to say family is, I think, more accurate because I'm using the two basically interchangeably, but family isn't a healthy family the place where there is this unity? We are connected. We are a unit. We are a whole. At the same time that each individual is recognized for his or her unique gifts.
Ideally.
I'd say that's what the healthy family looks like.
Ideally,
It's got both. And we're saying, I think, let me presume that we are saying.
the royal we, yes.
that a functioning democracy is very much aspires to something similar. So it's not, again, we're back to the moral dimensions that are not about procedure. Every 4 years I go vote and, you know, and I know that there are three branches of government. All of that's important, but what the moment we're in requires excavating the moral dimensions. And a piece of the moral dimension is exactly, I think, exactly this, the salad. The salad metaphor.
Well, and I have to go back. I mean, as you're speaking, I'm reminded of something you said a couple of weeks ago that I just thought was so clear and so brilliant, but that, or at least what I heard you say was that.
I'm sure I said it.
especially if it landed as brilliant, that we all need to be conservative and we all need to be liberal. That we need, and boy, there's the heart of democracy right there, right? We've got to be able to hold those things in balance. There have to be certain things that we agree on and hold as inalienable truths. And that has to define the center. And not necessarily going to define the periphery, but at least there's a center. We agree where the center is. And it feels like that balance in a family shows up where, yeah, there are certain agreements about how we're going to be together and who we are to one another and how we stand for one another, particularly when things get challenging, and yet still give people enough room to be wholly, authentically, and fully who they are and not try to remake our kids over in our image.
So let me inject something that should be problematic. Not problematic in the sense of trouble, but problematic in the sense of provocative, maybe is a better word. The Ellison quote, he talks about democracy, he talks about home, he talks about love. He says that love is a piece of this. So that's my question. Like, how, and love, so we use it in so many different ways and sometimes very, very shallow ways.
I don't think he was using it.
And he was not. No,
I think he is using love as the alpha and the omega.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's what I want to just lift up with you and see if we can fluff this up a little bit. How does he use it, or how would you imagine him using the word love in relation to home and democracy?
Again, because he's impressionist, so he's thrown something down on the paper, and there's a couple of different ways we can see it. When I hear it, it reminds me of, because he throws the word democracy in there, it leads me to a place where I think about my love for the aspiration of America, my love for democracy and for my country is rooted in its ideal, not in some notion that we've ever attained it, but in its ideal. Now, you know, the scriptures say that in love, there is no greater gift than to lay down our lives for another. What would I lay down my life for? Would I lay down my life for this ideal? Do I cherish it? Do I love it enough to really go after it? And I think, you know, when you listen to some on the extreme right who, you know, don't want, who are, you know, being extraordinarily racist in their slamming of wokeness, their fear is that we're trashing the nation, that we're but it's not about trashing the nation. It's about being honest about where we've gone wrong so that we can go right, so that we can get back to the ideal. But of course, then we never have that. The conversation never finishes, because as soon as one individual discerns in the other individual, oh, you're one of them, right? The conversation's over. You MSNBC listening, latte sipping, hybrid driving. Yeah, all of that. And you are a swamp Yankee gun toting, beer drinking, NASCAR watching. So we never get to the place of realizing, hey, wait a minute. At the end of the day, might we be getting into a massive urinary Olympics totally unnecessarily, because we're seeking the same thing. We are coming from, we're getting at it in different ways. I think when Ellis uses the word love, he's talking about, and I talk about this all the time, about binding ourselves to something like the sea captains of old bound themselves to the mast so they would not get lured overboard. But whatever the ideal was they were binding themselves to, their lives, their very lives depended on it. So they bound themselves to the mast. And something in what he's saying lands for me like that love, or like go back and listen to Martin Luther King's, you know, sermon about love, not about overly emotional or, you know, but agape, that core, the alpha and the omega, the thing, it begins and ends there.
Yeah. I'll give you a slightly different riff that has some overlap on the word love here. I wonder if he might mean simply seeing the personhood of the other. Mm. Now, when you were,
brilliant.
In a couple ways,
brilliant.
You touched on this when you were doing kind of the nothing but, like that, the things that shut down the conversation, and that person is nothing but a blah, 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 blah. You don't see the personhood there. You just see these little categories, and then we can slot the person in. Ellison, 1953, this is pre-Voting Rights Act, pre-all kinds of different things. So I'm thinking of the racial dimension, the inability of certain racist people and practices back then, the inability of seeing the personhood of Black Americans. So love, again, yeah, not the sentimentality, but something very much theologically grounded, I would say, in agreement with you, theologically grounded in, I'll just say it again, seeing the personhood. It sounds so simple, but it's really, really
But look at how
hard.
Look at how beautifully that notion that you just expressed, and it really is brilliant. Look at how beautifully that gets us past potentially the arguments between, let's say, America in the 21st century, right v. left, over what we're teaching in schools. You know, because now instead of an us versus them, it's about an idea. In playing the game of the game is called, how shall we reach the aspiration? Okay. So now we've got some different ideas about training or about how to, you know, some people might think that the best way to win the game is just to score a whole bunch of three-pointers, and that may work against some teams. You know, you got to change up your strategy depending on the team you're playing, right? So in the same way, there are different ways to get to the aspiration. There are those of us who feel that we cannot reach the aspiration until we have confessed where we have fallen short. So, you know, beginning with failing to see the divinity of Indigenous peoples, whose land we now dwell on, that led to, that made it easy, right? Because once you've, you know, decimated the humanity of one people, it's much easier to decimate the humanity of another. So then, you know, slavery, and then making reparations, then taking them back, reconstruction, deconstruction, civil rights, human rights, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, you know, now all of these things spin off, but it's a conversation about how shall we get to the promised land, as opposed to, oh, we want to get to the promised land, but you don't. We're right, you're wrong. And I think what happens is, in the absence of being able to have these deeper and broader conversations, we get to a place where it's difficult and lacking curiosity, where we began today, lacking the core of curiosity, we shut down, as opposed to at that point saying, I don't know. I wonder. So many questions, Chris, and not nearly enough time to answer them all.
Be curious, Shayna.
Go deep.
And shine light.
You have been listening to What in God's Name, the podcast of the S1 Project. Our show is made possible today because of our generous donors on Patreon, and we want to invite all of you to join that generous group on Patreon by going to Patreon,
P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Shayna, what a great pleasure to be with you today and to talk about this Ralph Ellison quote. I'm grateful.
Thanks for bringing it to our attention, Chris. It was wonderful. Have a sparkling day.